Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith, amateur radio operator W0NX, featuring the August 2025 The Spectrum Monitor. We'll begin by continuing Radio 101 by Ken Reitz, KS4ZR. Getting started, HF Aeronautical Listening. Compare the R-34's average speed of 43 miles per hour with the modern commercial airliner at 600 miles per hour. The time of a 3,200-mile one-way crossing is reduced from 108 hours to 5.3 hours. Two images on this page show the screens of a radio with a spectrum scope. In one image, the image shows 8.825 spectrum scope. A high level is indicated on the scope with stations indicated as lines. The other image shows the same 8.825 and a very low level of wideband background activity, but with indicated stations still displayed. The captions read, "Improving your reception noise floor, monitoring Atlantic high-frequency aeronautical traffic using an ICOM IC7300 and listening on 8,825 kHz, New York Radio Air Traffic Control for aircraft flying the Caribbean and North Atlantic region." The photo at left shows signal strength and band conditions during daylight hours using the large horizontal loop at 30 feet. Notice the high noise floor. The photo at right shows the same signal on the much quieter 700-foot long wire antenna at 8 feet. A signal at the same strength sounds considerably louder and clearer without the background noise. KS4ZR photos. Back to the text. What you need to tune in. To get started, you don't need anything more than a shortwave radio that has single sideband SSB reception capability and an external antenna. Powerful land-based stations, such as New York Radio, located in Riverhead, Long Island, New York, on the East Coast, and San Francisco Radio on the West Coast, transmit an upper sideband, USB, which is receivable on any modern amateur radio high-frequency rig. Many inexpensive portable shortwave radios, such as the XH-Data D808, $108 shipped free for Amazon Prime customers, and others that we've reviewed over the years. Aside from SSB reception, the D808 has a built-in external antenna jack that makes attaching to an external antenna much easier and far more effective than using the telescoping whip antenna most portable shortwave radios come with. If you're already familiar with the routine exchange of information from air traffic controllers to pilots at a local airport or busy regional hub, you'll find an even bigger world in high-frequency aeronautical listening. One that stretches thousands of miles, often entirely over water. If you're not familiar with aeronautical shortwave, you may be wondering why pilots are using shortwave frequencies to communicate. When any plane, commercial airliner, or private luxury jet takes off from any coast headed for an overseas destination, it almost immediately goes out of range for VHF communications that it normally would use over land. Satellite communications work well, but effectiveness declines as airliners fly closer to the higher latitude routes, including those referred to as polar routes. The only communications that work well around the world year-round is old-fashioned, dependable shortwave. Among avid shortwave listeners, the frequencies used for aeronautical communications fall into the category referred to as utility or ute stations. For decades, Larry Van Horn, Hugh Stegman, Mike Chase Ortiz, Dan Myers, and others have explained how all of this works. And if you haven't been a regular reader, you can go back and get up to speed through their past columns and features. Meanwhile, here are the basics. For U.S. listeners, separate frequency lists for Atlantic and Pacific routes are detailed here. radio.arinc.net/Atlantic. Note that the list is kept up to date by the hour. Depending on your location in North America, you'll probably want to use the chart that's nearest your location to start. Starting on the U.S. East Coast, I use the Atlantic frequency assignments. The Atlantic charts are further broken down to Gulf of Mexico, South America, Caribbean, North Atlantic, Northeast U.S., and Eastern Atlantic, with primary and secondary frequencies listed, and long-distance operational control, LDOC, phone patch, primary and secondary frequencies also listed. Like all shortwave frequencies, some work better during daylight hours, typically the higher frequencies listed, and others better at night, typically the lower frequencies listed. Likewise, for Pacific frequencies, which you can get to by clicking on the Pacific tab at the top of the radio.arinc.net page. These transmissions are, for the most part, routine, with pilots identifying themselves by airline and flight number. Those two details allow you to enter them at flightaware.com, where you can see photos of the plane, know the airspeed and altitude, and details as to the type of aircraft, where it took off from, where it's headed, and where it is at the moment. Hearing the pilot's voice and seeing that it's out over the Atlantic headed for South America gives you an interesting perspective on the radio technology involved. Those 200-watt transceivers and vertical stabilizer-embedded antennas and 30,000 feet in altitude really give these airborne stations some serious coverage. Two images on this page show first a screenshot of a radio with a spectrum scope. The text on the scope reads 8,918. There are several signals indicated on the spectrum scope. The other image is a computer screenshot of a FlightAware web page. The background image is a map of the U.S., and a plane and its flight path are overlaid on the map. The text on the map reads MIA AAL52B772 35,604 MIA FCO 12:38 p.m. The captions for these two images read, Left, New York Radio, located in Riverhead, Long Island, New York. In this photo, is in contact with an airliner out over the Atlantic on 8,918 kilohertz upper sideband. The primary frequency for aircraft in the Gulf of Mexico or South America from 0300 Zulu to 1100 Zulu. Both New York Radio and the aircraft have great signals here on the east coast of the U.S. KS4ZR photo. Once you copy the airline name and flight number from the HF frequency you're monitoring, you can go to flightaware.com and enter those two details. The website shows that in real time, this flight just left Miami, Florida for Rome, Italy, and was flying at 35,000 feet at 604 miles per hour. Courtesy FlightAware.com. Back to the text. It's not uncommon to have special weather advisories given by the land station to the crews of these aircraft, typically of thunderstorms in or near their planned routes. You can actually see these storm fronts on the radar on flightaware.com and know what's ahead for the plane. Sometimes things get a little dicey in the air. Monitoring the LDOC phone patch frequencies, you'll sometimes hear the pilot talking with medical personnel on the ground regarding ongoing medical situations involving a passenger. The conversation can be intense, but all involved are consummate professionals and always seem quite calm. Still, it highlights the risks of moving at over 600 miles per hour at 37,000 feet, halfway to the destination over water in a crowded airplane. Another frequency to monitor is found on the Pacific side, San Francisco radio, on the frequency list under Other Regions and Polar Routes. Three frequencies are listed. Primary, 17,925 kHz. Secondary, 13,348 kHz. And tertiary, 11,342 kHz. Aircraft taking the route over the North Pole have almost no chance of using normal SATCOM frequencies. Unlike your local ATC or regional hub, you won't hear nonstop chatter on any of these frequencies, and given the distances involved, the land station will often ask for repeats of the airline and flight number, and request repeats of readbacks when information is given. Band conditions, even for these stations, are often not the best. I use my IC7300 to monitor the HF aeronautical band and typically use the 800-foot horizontal loop for receiving. But during the day, when atmospheric noise is highest, I'll often switch to the 700-foot long wire, which, at 8 feet above ground, is a much quieter receiving antenna. At night, as you may imagine, there are fewer flights. I heard aircraft on the Eastern Atlantic primary frequency, 8,906 kHz. Remember to tune USB. Your rig may automatically set it as LSB. And heard very strong signals from the Pacific side as well, flying out of North America to Asia on 13,288 kHz. I heard both aircraft and San Francisco radio with strong signals. The signal on 13,261 kHz from Hawaii was heard well here, as were transmissions from aircraft over the North Pole. But wait, there's more. This is just the beginning of what can be heard. There are more layers to HF aeronautical monitoring that you'll discover as you work your way into this end of shortwave listening. One such other facet is high-frequency data link, HFDL. This is the HF version of ACARS, the Aircraft Communications Addressing and Reporting System. Data transmissions that broadcast various details of the aircraft sending these regular data bursts, which can be read on any computer that has the necessary software to display the data. Such data can include weather reports, aircraft systems status, text messages from the crew to ground, or vice versa. There are several excellent videos available on YouTube that show how to receive HFDL transmissions. But to do so also requires a software-defined radio with appropriate cables and software to decode these data bursts. HFDL transmissions are made on a completely different set of frequencies, though within the same general band of HF air traffic control frequencies discussed earlier. Klingenfuss's 2025 Shortwave Frequency Guide has more about HFDL, including frequencies on which these are found around the world, as well as many more. One thing about monitoring HF aeronautical transmissions is that it helps to have a frequency, say New York radio or San Francisco radio, that you can monitor for quite a while, almost as background sound, while you work on some bench project or work on your computer. you'll become familiar with the voices of these HF stations, their on-air procedures, and even follow a flight as it progresses across the ocean. An image on this page shows a computer screenshot. On the screen are several windows with maps and text and spectrum displays shown. The caption reads, "Many YouTube videos, such as this one from Frugal Radio, explain how to set up for advanced HFDL, ACARS on HF, aeronautical reception, using software-defined radios and available software. Courtesy Frugal Radio via YouTube." Back to the text. KS4ZR Field Day Report. As usual, it was a hot and muggy day in central Virginia as the hour approached for Field Day 2025. My plan was simple. String up an off-center-fed OCF dipole in a very open area of the yard, repurpose a 40-volt, 6-amp-hour electric chainsaw battery as a power supply, and have it all set up for the official start at 1800 UTC. It started out well. After lunch, I dragged the old OCF dipole out to the site, pulled the center connector up about 35 feet into a big oak tree. The legs of the dipole were secured inverted V fashion in convenient trees nearby, with the antenna favoring an east-west orientation. The height at the center made it perfect to attach the 40 or so feet of window feed line to the rig via a 4-to-1 ballon. A table was set up under the tree where the rig would be placed. By now, I was sweating profusely in the 100-plus heat index air, and a glance at the clock told me it was already the start of field day. Earlier, the battery indicated it had a full charge, but hooking it up to the voltmeter showed it was just slightly under 40 volts, not a good sign. Using a DC-to-DC transformer, I hooked up the IC7300 to the battery, and it worked great on receive. But one touch of the mic showed the battery was more than a little under voltage, even at 5 watts out. So it would have to be put on the charger. Precious hours would be wasted. So I pulled down the OCF dipole, put the rig, the table, and everything else back where they belonged. The desk where I operate from is on a circuit which is part of the dedicated loads panel in the garage, separate from the main electrical service. That box is fed by the 1,000-amp-hour, 48-volt battery backup system that is in turn fed by 15 PV panels, about 3,500 watts, on the roof, up-converted to 120 volts and tied to the grid. It functions as the emergency power system, which floats 24/7, going through cycles of charging and discharging or exercising the AGM batteries in the backup battery bank. With the rig attached to the big horizontal loop antenna, I would be operating as a single operator on backup power with only 5 watts output. By now, it was 1900 UTC and not one station was in the log. The pressure was on because a glance at the radar showed thunderstorms were starting to develop across the nearby Blue Ridge Mountains and headed east. My purpose with Field Day is to work as many stations as far away as I can, in as many directions as I can, given my 5 watts single sideband output and jam-packed frequencies on all available bands. From experience, it's best to start out where there are fewer field day stations calling CQ. With less QRM, it's more likely my 5 watts will get through. I first checked 10 meters, but in this location, as field day got underway, only a few Latin American stations were heard, working the King of Spain contest. My next stop was 15 meters, then 20 meters, and finally 40 meters. I only worked one station on 40. By the time the thunder started, I had worked Alabama, North Carolina, Puerto Rico, southern New Jersey, North Texas, Georgia, South Texas, Minnesota, South Dakota, Illinois, and California, virtually all directions on the compass, with distances exceeding 1,000 miles in each direction. A few observations from 2025 Field Day. In general, band conditions where I live were better than last year, noticeably so. Being able to work West Coast stations with as little as 5 watts into pile-ups was proof of that. I'm always amused at hams who insist on having their Saturday 20-meter roundtable nets, toughing it out, despite the mayhem on their frequency. It's also true that the miscreants on 40 meters won't give their antics a rest for Field Day weekend. Instead, some hams seem to find it necessary to join in. It was good to hear a fair number of young lady YL voices in the mix, as well as a good number of kids and newcomers. Patience among almost all operators was high, something I, with my little 5 watts of SSB in a sea of 100 watt plus voices, really benefited from. There were a few alligator operators, all mouth, no ears, whose huge signals dominated a frequency but couldn't hear the dozens of stations coming back to their CQ. And there were only a few professional contesters who appeared annoyed when stations called were not quite as fast as they were on the exchange of information. According to the ARRL, more than 30,000 amateurs participated in Field Day. That's less than 5% of all licensed U.S. amateurs, if license numbers are to be believed, though it sounded as if all 30,000 were on 20 meters. And now, is the death of U.S. AM broadcast radio exaggerated? What We Know and One Key Thing We Do Not by Frank M. Howell, Ph.D., K4FMH. An image on this page shows a spectrum display of a radio. The display shows many closely spaced vertical lines. The caption reads, "The U.S. medium wave band, as seen on a Kiwi SDR receiver based in the National Quiet Zone in Monterey, Virginia, July 1st, 2025, KS4ZR photo." Back to the text. The famous Mark Twain line offered in a letter to a newspaper editor who published his obituary seems to crop up frequently. So many like to say what the future holds based on either some highly publicized single event or a short-term trend in observations. Then subsequent reality proves them wrong. We read and hear much about the demise of AM broadcasting in the U.S. The best available public evidence on the state of AM broadcast radio is that it is not dead, but is simply changing, along with the entire broadcast media, including FM radio and terrestrial television. There is one key piece of data that is not public, but we need to know it to forecast AM radio's future in the U.S. In the following study, I look at three central aspects of the issue: the number of station licensees over time, the audience magnitude and media market patterns, and investments in that audience through advertising dollars. I additionally show how these national trends are shaped by multiple local media markets rather than being a homogeneous national pattern. As the reader will see, AM terrestrial radio is far from dead. We'll continue this article next time. Thank you for joining us for Hobby Radio, read by Keith.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.